Tonight on Arena. In TV, we reviewed Dope Thief, Adolescence and The Leopard, and Edwyn Collins is among the albums for review. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena. Or you can watch live on rt.ie/arena. So first up this evening, our TV reviews. Netflix brings us Adolescence, a family drama starring Stephen Graham and directed by Philip Barantini, who we spoke to on Wednesday's Arena. The four-part drama unfolds when an ordinary home in a north of England town is raided and a 13-year-old boy is arrested and accused of murdering a classmate. Each episode is filmed in one single shot and follows the fallout in the boy's school and the devastation in his family after the arrest. And from an early morning raid in England, we move to a fake raid in Philadelphia. Dope Thief is a crime thriller starring Brian Tyree Henry and Wagner Moura, who play long-term friends and former conflicts, Ray and Manny. They have perfected a scam where they pretend to be DEA agents and rob dope houses. But this small-time scam has a life and death consequences when they unwittingly raid one of America's biggest narcotics operations. And finally, we move to the beautiful landscape of Sicily in the latest adaptation of Lampedusa's classic The Leopard on Netflix. This sumptuous series stars Kim Rossi Stewart as Don Fabrizio, the Prince of Selina, and the eponymous leopard, who recognises that his privileged life is under threat as Italy moves towards unification. His family's future is in jeopardy and the prince must reluctantly adapt to survive. Chris Wasser has watched all three and is in studio with me. So Chris, let's start with Adolescence, which Stephen Graham created and co-wrote with the great Jack Thorne. He also stars as Eddie Miller, whose life implodes when the police raid the house.
They do. They raid the Miller household at 6 a.m. one morning. DI Luke Bascombe, Ashley Walters and his colleagues. And when they break in the door, Eddie is standing there completely baffled, saying, "What are you doing? Why are you here? You must have, whatever this is about, you must have the wrong house." But Bascombe says, "No, we're here for your son." They're here for 13-year-old Jamie Miller, played brilliantly by a newcomer named Owen Cooper. And as it turns out, Jamie is being arrested and charged with the murder of a classmate. And this is, again, just a shock to his parents. And the first episode brings us down to the police station where Jamie is questioned and charged. And over the following three episodes, we fast forward a couple of days and then a few months to when Jamie is interviewed by a child psychologist, and we see the impact that his arrest and these charges have on the family.
Let's listen to a clip first. This is the opening scene where the police arrive at the Miller home to arrest the 13-year-old Jamie, while his father, Eddie, insists there must be a mistake. Father and son, as you say, are played by Stephen Graham and Owen Cooper, with Ashley Walters as the police officer.
Mom!
Hey, he's only a kid, mate!
He's about to knock out!
Okay.
Hey!
Jamie Miller.
What's going on?
The time is 6:15 a.m. and I'm arresting you on suspicion of murder. You do not have to say anything. But Mr. Miller, I will arrest you for obstruction. Please stop. Please. I'm arresting you on suspicion of murder. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention one question, something which you later rely on in court.
Dad?
Anything you do say may be given in evidence.
Dad,
do you understand?
I haven't done anything!
Do you understand?
Son,
do you understand?
Just tell me you understand, Jay. All right, I understand.
Okay, good. Get up slowly, please. You got anything in your pockets that may harm me or you?
No.
Okay. You want to change your trousers?
Yeah.
You want me to get your dad?
Yes, please.
Don't move. Stand down, please. Stand down.
Stand down.
Mr. Miller, you need to come upstairs. He's had an accident.
Hey?
You need to help him, please. Thank you.
You're okay, love.
Come on, Chris.
Jake?
Ashley Walters there as the police officer, Owen Cooper as the boy, and Stephen Graham as his father. From the very beginning, the excitement of that opening scene and opening episode, really, that you go from the two, Ashley Walters as the policeman sitting in the car, and suddenly the whole police force are in the door of the Miller's home.
Yeah, it's frightening. And you also have, I mean, we went through the story, but the part of adolescence that's been making headlines recently is the fact that Philip Barantini, who directed it, Philip Barantini being an acclaimed and accomplished director who gave us a film called Boiling Point, which also starred Stephen Graham, and it was all done in one continuous take. And it was all set in a restaurant on the night when this frazzled chef, which Stephen Graham played, realizes that he's in serious financial trouble and it's the most stressful night of the year in this restaurant. They've adopted a similar approach with the same cinematographer Matthew Lewis, where each of the four episodes in Adolescence was filmed in one unbroken take. And some listeners might be listening to me now and thinking, well, look, that is easier to do these days. And we've seen more and more films and shows where that's being done, and with careful storyboarding and rehearsals and, you know, just meticulous planning, the same way you would plan a play, that these things are easier to do. But there, some of the technical wizardry involved here, it's just astonishing. I found myself rewinding some scenes. I eventually settled into it because you'll spoil it for yourself if you go looking for it. But the way the camera is going up and down corridors, up and down stairways, from the house where we heard that arrest to the police station, over to the young boy's school, it's brilliant. But also you might be thinking, is that the only thing that Adolescence has going for it? Because if it was just that, if it was down to this one-shot gimmick, that's all it would be, a gimmick. But the writing, as you might hear there, and also the performances, it's just astonishing. You know, there is a story here worth telling, and it's a story that's very well told.
We spoke to, as I say, Stephen and Philip about their decision to use the one-shot technique on Wednesday's Arena, and this is what they said.
Well, I mean, it, you know, the one take format, you really need to think about, you know, is it the right subject for that that technique? And what it does is it forces an audience to sit up and pay attention, and, you know, to look at it from a specific perspective. You're not cutting away. You're not cutting 2 days later. You're not cutting to hands and, you know, close ups on faces. That you're not. The audience are seeing it play out live. And what that does is it creates an extra layer of tension and sort of anxiety, subconscious anxiety. And I think this particular subject matter really did lend itself to that. What we wanted to do is we didn't want to have, you know, the whole thing bookended and really neatly tied up in a bow. You know, each episode is just a moment in time, and it's real time. It's almost live, played out live.
Yeah, there's Philip Barantini there explaining it. And as Stephen Graham picked me up and he said, it's one camera.
Yeah.
So like the camera is chasing the actors.
Yes.
And the actors equally have to respond and give the performance of their lives because they know that they can't cut or break the action.
Yeah, and you really can't mess up the effort that went into this. And I like what Philip Barantini was saying there. It's the one take approach. It's responsible for adding to that building of attention, but it's not responsible for all of it. You know, it can't just be that this is the only part of Adolescence that makes it special. I think what makes Adolescence special is, as far as from what I've seen anyway, this is one of the first dramas that really addresses you know, issues and explores the issue of this so-called manosphere, which comes up quite a bit, and also incel culture and that toxic culture online where vulnerable young minds like Jamie Miller, who we heard at the beginning there, where they're exposed to these rotten, rancid, you know, ideas of what men should be and how men should react. Because going into this, some viewers might think, oh, this is maybe a little bit of a, I say murder mystery, but you might think, oh, we're going to spend the next 4 hours wondering if Jamie really did this. It sort of tells you from very early on who is responsible for this crime and what actually happened. It's more about how did this happen, you know, and, you know, is a murderer formed in the home? You know, do they pick up, you know, horrible traits from their home environment, or are they picking them up online? And it really, it's the first show that I've come across that really explores those ideas, those very frightening modern ideas.
Yes, and it's very much in episode 3 when the young boy, played by Owen Cooper, interacts. He plays Jamie, and he interacts with the child psychologist, played by Aaron Doherty. And it's here all those issues of incel, as you say, and that kind of online bullying, and how young men feel about themselves and the rage they have to young women. Here is a clip from that episode.
I'm interested in the fact that you think you're ugly, Jamie.
Yeah, I'm fascinated.
I'm interested in it because what you think is more important to me than what is true, okay? So how do you feel about being ugly?
How would you feel? You don't know. You're not. You're pretty.
This isn't about me, Jamie.
What? You don't think you're pretty?
I'm not the interesting person in this room.
You don't think you're pretty? You do think I'm ugly?
I haven't passed judgment on either of those things. If you think about it, for very good reason.
Oh, for very good reason.
I want to understand you.
To understand my understanding of my understanding of my understanding.
Yes.
The other bloke is much more easy.
Okay.
Him checking whether I understand was much easier. Whether I understand what I did. No, fuck off! I didn't fucking say that! You're fucking putting words in my mouth! Oh, it's like a fucking trap in here!
Aaron Doherty there as the child psychologist and Owen Cooper there as Jamie. I mean, they're ferocious scenes. They're so intimate because the two of them are in a room together, and it's like a tennis match, but very tense tennis match.
Yeah, and that episode in particular, because that episode, you know, we were talking about the fact that we go from schools to police stations, and sometimes the camera soars over the air to go to a different part of the village. And in that third episode, we were in that interview room for the most part with Aaron Doherty and Owen Cooper, and we all know that Aaron Doherty is a phenomenal talent. We've seen her in The Crown, and we've seen her in A Thousand Blows of Stephen Graham. We have never seen Owen Cooper before, and this is the first time that Owen Cooper, who's 15, playing a 13-year-old here, he was 14 when they shot it, he had no acting experience. He had just joined an agency. He had just started studying drama in school. He put forward a self-audition tape for Philip Barantini and was auditioned with around 500 or 600 young male actors for this role, and he won it. And it's just an incredible debut. And of course, he's surrounded by heavyweight talent. Stephen Graham here, we've spoken about him many times on the show before, but this is probably the best work that he's done. There's a scene in this which is just heartbreaking, where Jamie's brought down to the station. He elects his father as his appropriate adult to be there for the questioning. And unfortunately, Jamie is strip searched by the police, and the camera just stays on Stephen Graham's face as this father begins to realise, you know, because he doesn't want to believe this awful thing that his son may have done. But it's during this scene, when this is happening to his son, that he realizes the life that may be ahead for him. And it's all about reaction. And Stephen Graham is so good at reacting to these horrible things. It's an incredible performance.
So does it sustain itself over the four episodes?
It does. It's probably, you might need a break, whatever about the Philip Barantini and Matthew Lewis not taking a break between cuts, you might actually need a break while you're watching this, but it's an incredible piece of work. I mean, we sit here every week and we tell you that a show is good, 4 stars, a show might not be great, 2 stars. This is just unmissable television. It's just the best writing, it's the best acting, and it's the best storytelling and the best filming that I've come across in a very long time.
Does that mean 5 out of 5?
It's perfect. If I could give it more, I would.
Fantastic. Now we turn to Dope Thief, a crime thriller set in Philadelphia, not to be confused with the similarly named Dope Sick. It's a completely different tone, but still there's an awful lot of camaraderie, and it's almost a buddy crime movie or crime series.
Yeah, a lot of dark humor in there, which is actually quite funny. It is essentially about two Philadelphia friends who are pretending to be DEA agents. And when we first meet them, they're actually quite good at it. When we first meet Ray, played by Brian Tyree Henry, and Manny, played by Wagner Moura, they are on a bit of a stakeout. And for the first few minutes, we actually think that they might be DEA agents. They have the jacket. jackets, they have the caps. Importantly, they have the badges and they also have the weapons. And they perform this drug bust. They go in and they cuff the bad guys and they take away their drugs and they take away their cash. And, you know, they're full of all of these funny sayings and they're very confident and cocky. But then we realize that they're these, well, they like to think that they are these Robin Hood figures. They're going in and taking the drugs for themselves and they're taking the cash and they're using them to, you know, basically live their lives and also, you know, make their own families' lives better. And they have this small operation, but of course, eventually they get a bit greedy and they get word that there's a big house an hour outside of Philadelphia. And just at a moment when they think, you know, maybe it's time to start winding down, you know, we've probably hit too many houses, people are going to start recognizing us, they do this famous one last job. They end up basically stealing from the worst gangsters on the Eastern Seaboard.
Now, let's listen to what you said, where they were masquerading as DEA agents, and they're doing it very well. So here is Brian Tyree, Henry and Wagner Mora playing Ray and Manny.
Skills.
Hey, drop the ball. DEA. You just pause the game?
On the ground, federal agents, I want to see those hands.
Yo, just breathe, all right? Think of this like a fire drill that they teach you in school? Oh, look at this. Yo, why the Magic School Bus so heavily armed, huh? Is Frizzle packing? Serious lemonade stand, man. And instead of selling pop rock, you're selling crack rock, huh? All right.
This one is Jerome.
Oh, we got Jerome in the house. We got Jerome in the in your mouth. What's going on, Jerome? Hey, what the hell kind of babysitter are you, man? This is terrible. I mean, look at this. The worst damn daycare I ever seen in my life. Hey. Iverson Jr., look at me, talk to me, man. Where's the money and the rest of the shit? Hey, keep your mouth shut, Jerome. You know, as a matter of fact, I'm talking to you now. Who the man of the house right now, Jerome? That's funny. I'm gonna ask you again. Who's the man of the house right now, Jerome?
You.
That's right.
There's Brian Tyree Henry masquerading as a DEA officer and Wagner Mora is his sidekick. Now, Wagner Mora is very good in this.
Yes.
But my goodness, Brian Tyree Henry is just, he just exudes charm.
You could power a small country with that man's charisma. He is an exceptional talent. And he delivers a thrilling, as you heard there, funny and also quite a moving performance because Ray and Manny, you know, they're doing bad things. They're doing questionable things, but they're not bad guys. They've had an awful lot of bad luck. They had rough upbringings. They actually met in prison. So they're former convicts, but they're also recovering addicts. And all Ray really wants to do is just, and he's also grieving, we learn in later episodes, the loss of a close friend who might've been something more. So he's just trying to just make a better life for himself. And he's trying to look after his adopted mother, played by Kate Mulgrew. He's trying to put his relationship with his abusive father, played by Ving Rhames, who's actually behind bars, behind him. He just wants everything to be okay, but unfortunately he has a permanent rain cloud over his head, a million frustrations.
Yes, they tell some of his backstory in flashbacks
yes.
that are done in black and white. And I thought at the beginning, they really are trying to make us
yeah.
win us over. This is too much
yeah.
that they're putting in his biography to make us like him. But then he is so likable
yeah.
anyway.
You know? That's the thing. I mean, he has so many, you know, as I said, like a million frustrations and is messed up in things he probably shouldn't be. But he's a nice guy and he is trying to look after his nearest and dearest, and he is trying to make everything better for himself. And Brian Tyree Henry kind of, you know, he finds that light and he holds onto it throughout the entire series, and that's what makes us, you know, root for him. It is a bit formulaic, you know, it is like it is a bit too silly at times. You know, as I say, there is a gangster after him, he keeps calling him up on the phone, and he's kind of got this really deep, scary voice, and that for me was just a bit, you know, it was just a bit too much at times.
Let's listen to another clip. This is where Ray, this is the Brian Tyree Henry, he drops in to see Teresa, his father's ex-girlfriend, who looked after him as a young boy when no one else would.
Raymond, you want coffee?
Yeah, am I making it or you? You know what? Never mind. I'm leaving anyway. I gotta go to work. And Manny's coming to pick me up.
Degenerate.
Hey, seriously, what's wrong with you?
You sick? You need money?
I can't pay anybody like that.
Hey, what I work so hard for? You just said how much you need.
I need 10 grand.
The hell you need 10 grand for?
I don't expect you to have that kind of money. How are you painting so many houses in this cold?
Interiors. What? Anything you want to say to me today?
Yeah. Can you walk Shermie for me? He's been cooped up all day. Haven't you, Daddy? Yeah. And don't forget to pick up your shit.
So that's the home life he has. And that is obviously her need for money is obviously the reason that he goes and does this very, very unwise heist. Stars out of five for Dope Thief.
I like this a lot. And I also like the fact that Ridley Scott, who's an executive producer, directs the first episode here. And it's the best direction I've seen from Ridley Scott in a long time, away from, you know, the historical epic. So do more gangster stuff, Ridley Scott, because it really, really suits you.
Yeah, second bust is just terrific.
Yeah, yeah. I like this a lot. Like the characters, like the writing. I'm having a good time. I'll see it through to the end. 4 stars.
4 out of 5. And that's for Dope Thief on Apple TV. Now, the third show is The Leopard, and that's also on Netflix. People might be aware of Visconti's classic film, which had Burt Lancaster as Prince Fabrizio, made a long time ago. But it has been a hugely influential film on people like Scorsese and the like.
Absolutely, yeah. It is, of course, based on Giuseppe Tomasi di Lampedusa's 1958 novel, which won the Segre Prize, highest prize in Italian literature when it was published. It was actually published a year after at some point after the author's death. But yes, within 5 years, it was made into a film by Luchino Visconti. Burt Lancaster was in it. Famously, Burt Lancaster, various different actors in the film were speaking in different languages, which must have been just, you know, a nightmare. But the film is such an impressive piece of work that you had, you know, Sidney Pollack, you had Martin Scorsese saying this is one of the greatest of all time. And it is a very impressive piece of work. But nobody until now has thought that it would make for a very impressive television show. So it takes a complex story. I mean, in terms of, you know, it's a simple family story, but there are a lot of complex politics happening behind the scenes. And it expands it over 6 episodes.
So we're in sun-soaked Sicily.
We are.
And then this Fabrizio is royalty. And obviously, democracy is coming and he doesn't like it.
He doesn't. He wants things to stay the same, but as various different characters famously tell him throughout, you know, for everything to stay the same, things have to change. So it is set in the 1860s in Sicily. The unification of Italy has begun, and Garibaldi's red shirts have begun to sweep their way through the island.
Amazing.
And
the costumes are just terrific.
It is. There's a lot of money on show here, and it's the red shirt sweeping through Selena is very well done. And you do have Fabrizio telling his family that, look, we should move to the countryside of the state. We should, you know, hide out in the palace. We'll be fine there. And although he thinks that, you know, nothing bad is going to happen to him, his family, you know, they think otherwise. And they actually, Maria, his wife, she wants him to go and get Concetta, who's actually at a convent in the town, and bring her back to the palace. When he does that, it sort of reignites this friendship and potential romance between Concetta and her cousin Tancredi. And Tancredi is actually, although Fabrizio has a number of sons, and Tancredi is his nephew, it's almost like this is the son that I never had. This is the son that I wish the other two were. Unfortunately, Tancredi sides with the red shorts, and that causes a bit of a strain on their relationship.
And it's really about, isn't it? It's about a man out of time, Fabrizio.
Yes.
Like the world is moving on, and he still wants to have his lover in the city, his wife and family, all the respectability, his lands, all his wealth. But democracy is coming.
Oh, yeah.
At last.
He's a man of ancient privilege, and it's almost as though he wishes it were 100 years earlier so that he could enjoy that privilege the same way that his ancestors did. And he's so stubborn, and he's such a difficult character to like as well, because as you see him, he wants to be this protective family man, but every time he leaves the house, he's off to see one mistress here, another there. And, you know, he is so hard on his sons, but so soft on Tancredi. And Tancredi is out there fighting with the red shirts. At one point, it looks as though he might be publicly executed after being in prison and charged. And Fabrizio gives up half of his wealth just to protect his nephew. So he is a bit of a complicated man. As I said, you don't know whether to kind of, you know, turn your back on him or to root for him.
Tom Shackenclan, the director, is up against the memory of Visconti. How does he do, Chris?
Very well, I think. Yeah. Curiously, for a film or for a series all about Italian history and starring some accomplished Italian actors, you actually have an awful lot of British filmmakers behind the scenes. So you've got Tom Shankland, who worked on Ripper Street and more recently SAS Rogue Heroes, directing very well, you know, handling what sometimes is a bit of a slippery story quite well. You've got Benji Walters and Richard Warlow, who are British screenwriters. They're behind the story. It is very well acted. It's pretty to look at. You can feel the warmth coming off the screen. I will say the stuff, there's love triangle stuff down the line because Tancredi and Concetta, you know, there is a romance between them despite the fact that they're first cousins. And Tancredi's, you know, he might, you know, have someone else on the side. All of that stuff isn't really interesting. It's the politics that's interesting. But I mean, maybe you need a little bit more for the 6 hours. So it is worth the watch. Is it as good as, you know, the film that Scorsese loves? Probably not, but it's not the worst.
Okay, and stars out of 5 from you for that?
I think a solid 3 stars.
3 stars, okay. Well, Adolescence and the Leopard can be streamed now on Netflix, and episode 1 and 2 of Dope Thief are available on Apple TV. Chris Wasser, thank you. Now on Friday night's Arena, it's time for album reviews. Scottish singer-songwriter Edwyn Collins returns with Nation Shall Speak Unto Nation, his first album in 5 years, best known for his work with Orange Juice in the late 90s and a hit, A Girl Like You. His latest release reflects on memory and resilience after he suffered a debilitating stroke in 2005. Manchester indie outfit The Slow Readers Club follow up their 2023 album Knowledge, Freedom, Power with Out of a Dream. Known for their moody, synth-infused sound, the band has steadily built a loyal following and major festival slots. Their latest album leans into themes of paranoia, hope and self-doubt. Finally, Throwing Muses, led by Kristen Hirsch, returns with Moonlight Concessions, their first studio album since 2020, a key band in the 1980s, 90s alternative rock scene. Throwing Muses helped shape the sound of college radio along with bands like the Pixies and REM. I'm joined now by Danny Kilmartin and Louise Bruton, who have been listening to all 3 albums. First up is Edwyn Collins, Nation Shall Speak Unto Nation. But before we talk to our reviewers about it, let's remind listeners of one of Edwyn Collins' greatest 80s hits when he was frontman of Orange Juice. That was Rip It Up from the 1983 hit from Scottish indie pop band Orange Juice with Edwyn Collins on vocals. Danny, are you happy?
Very happy. It's probably my favourite song of all time, to be perfectly honest. I adore that song.
Louise, this album, Nation Shall Speak Unto Nation, reflects Collins's personal journey, particularly like he had to reclaim his voice, his movement, so many things after he got a stroke in 2005.
Yeah, so this is a very special album in many ways, and I think it's very important to note that Edwyn Collins is a very well-loved musician. He's a musician's musician. He's produced albums for the likes of Terrorvision, Vic Goddard, Robert Forster, The Cribs, and all of these musicians seem to gather around him. So in his journey to recovery, there was a documentary called Edwyn Collins Home Again that BBC Scotland airs, and the frontman of Franz Ferdinand narrated it, and it was all about his journey from his recovery from the stroke to playing the BBC proms. And the losing his speech must have been one of the most terrifying things that he has ever experienced. And that's where the title track comes from, Nation Shall Speak Unto Nation, which is the famous BBC motto about communication. Because when he lost his words, the only 4 phrases he could utter in his initial days of recovery were yes, no, the possibilities are endless, and then his wife's name, Grace Maxwell. And that's what the title track is about, where he used to always have a smart aleck response to things. And then during this time, all he had was his memories and his thoughts and those 4 phrases.
Well, let's listen to a little of Nation Shall Speak Unto Nation. Grilling way, talking in a That's the title track, Nation Speak Unto Nation, from Edwyn Collins's new album of the same name. Danny, I mean, it's just full of that. Well, he still has that wonderful baritone voice that we heard on It Up.
Absolutely.
But, you know, but it tells of the pain. And in a lot of the tracks, another track was Sound as a Pound. He says, sometimes it brings me down, the pain inside. Mm. So he's very open about what he's been through.
Yeah, and I think that's something that's really stood to him as a songwriter throughout his career. While there's always been a lot of kind of irony and kind of self-deprecation, he's just always been a very, very, very honest songwriter. And I think that's what's kind of led to him having this kind of almost statesman-like status, cult-like status within independent and alternative music mostly.
And what did you feel listening to his voice on this album? Did you feel, oh, it's back, or it's back, but it's been through, you know, been through a hard time?
It's absolutely. I mean, it's hard to kind of miss that that's what he's kind of aiming to get across on the album as well. I mean, he sets the tone right from the opening track, Knowledge. Like, it directly references his struggle to regain language after those strokes that he had in 2005. There's kind of a repeated mantra towards the end of the song where he keeps saying, like, it's hard to let my old self go. And I don't feel that he ever actually did let it go. He kind of, you know, it was always there. He just had to get it back in a way, you know.
I guess this is an album not only important for him, but important for all those musos who are such fans of his work, Louise.
Yeah, he seems to be a very constant presence in a lot of musicians' lives. And this is going to be his last album before he retires from touring. I don't know if that means retiring from making music as well, but he's definitely stepping back from the stage and from touring around with his music. So this seems like quite a significant album that's wrapping up on a lot of things. And as I mentioned, Grace Maxwell was one of the phrases that I could only say when he initially had his strokes. And the song Bridge Hotel seems to be a song about times that he loves spending with Grace. Bridge Hotel is an ode to a hotel in Helmsdale, which is north, 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 north of Scotland, where he lives. And it paints a very striking image of the things that he holds special now. And he's a keen birder. This is a fact that I just love. And on this track, you can hear different birds that you can hear around the hotel. And it's just very sweet and very important.
Well, let's listen to this. This is the Bridge Hotel.
The long summer nights, the pace of life, the song thrush sings past 10 o'clock in the evening.
There's the bird song in the Bridge Hotel from Edwyn Collins's Nation Shall Speak Unto Nation. Danny, I think you were impressed by the range of the sonic range he has on the album.
Yeah, like throughout the album, he does kind of blend that classic indie poppy sound with a lot of, like, there's soul, there's a lot of gospel harmonies on the album. The opening track has a little bit of country twang on it. And the closing track then, there's touches of bossa nova as well. And that's something that Collins has always been adept at doing. Like, there's always been something kind of not so much out of time but timeless about the music he's made throughout his career. He can throw his hand at anything and kind of make it sound current, you know.
Yes, Louise was saying how admired he is by so many musicians, but there's he's collected a great group of people to work on this album.
Yeah, it does have a kind of a who's who of musicians, as you would have said about the man himself earlier. Like, he worked with his longtime collaborators, Sean Reid, a multi-instrumentalist who's worked with Dexys and Manic Street Preachers. There's Jake Hutton as drummer, guitarists James Walburn and Carwin Ellis, who have both been in the Pretenders. And I think she was either a semi-finalist or a finalist in The Voice UK, but her name is Bianca White. She would have provided a lot of the gospel harmonies as well. So.
And I think you said his son
plays bass on the record as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Happy families there for Edwyn Collins. Stars out of five from you, Louise, for Nation Shall Speak Unto Nation.
I gave it 4 stars. I think this is a very authentic album, and you get such a true sense of who he is as a person. And I think that's a very rare gift, and he's using it to its full.
From you, Danny.
I would give it a 3. It's a good, solid listen. A little bit middle of the road at times, but the production is excellent. His baritone Jarl that we've grown to love over the years is still as strong as ever. But not quite excellent here for me.
Okay, 4 and 3 out of 5. You can always go home and listen to Rip It Up and start again.
Exactly.
Any time. Next we have Manchester band The Slow Readers Club, and their latest release is Out of a Dream. Louise, this band has been on the go since 2009. We were saying there's lots of 80s themes tonight, and even though they're not from the 80s, they're quite influenced by the 80s.
Yeah, you can tell that they have taken a lot of influence from the likes of Joy Division and Echo and the Bunnymen, and then have added their own kind of indie pop sheen to it, which is something a lot of bands would have done in around the early 2000s. And even though these have been going since 2009, their music hasn't really aged along well with them, because they could sound like anything from the last 15 years, unfortunately.
Okay, well, we'll dig into that in a second. Just tell us a little bit about them. There's brothers involved.
Yeah, there's the brothers, the Starkey brothers, Aaron and Curtis. And they kind of got huge commercial success out of nowhere. They were an indie band in the beginning. Their third album, 2018's Build a Tower, did very well. And then they released two albums in 2020, The Joy of the Return and 91 Days in Isolation, which... three guesses as to what that's about. But yeah, so they seem to have been doing very well off their own bat, and this is the latest one of that. And
I can see she's not impressed, can't you, Danny? So Out of a Dream, like, they have a lot of concerns about modern life, a lot about technology, for example.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot of lyricism about kind of detachment and just concern around technological advancements and its impact on us. Unfortunately, I think the detachment kind of extends itself to the songwriting as well. I found the lyrics were a little bit on the vague side, but look, I'm sure we can delve into that a little bit more.
Okay, well, I think we should play a track. This is Slow Readers Club and Know This I Am. I Am there from the Slow Readers Club, and Out of a Dream is their album. Louise, it's like they're on the verge of a great evil or something. There's definitely a lot of paranoia here. Either you can also hear that in Technofear, where they're obviously
Are very much singing a lot of these songs with wrought hands. They're trying to go for something quite political, but... you know, as we've got news channels here in front of us with actual bulletins going by, I think we're past the point of wrought hands. But while their political songs don't really land in a hard way, I do find that they, when they go for the more emotionally driven side of things, they do shine in a different sense.
Yes, I thought our song is a gorgeous song.
Yeah, there's two songs I thought that went quite well together in terms of knowing how to navigate relationship, and one of them was Little White Lies, and then the second one was Boy So Blue. Little White Lies was the one where they try to figure out in the start of a relationship what's a red flag and what's a green flag, and then when Boy So Blue, it's actually the brokenhearted end of that story where things actually didn't go that well at all. And the way that that Aaron's vocals kind of soar in the song, I think it's a bit more interesting than the baritone mimicry that he's doing trying to be Ian Curtis or the editors or anybody else.
You like some of the stylistic influences on the album?
I do. I mean, there is a lot to enjoy in terms of like the new wave or the post-punk or the kind of dark wave elements of it, but I just don't think it's greater than the sum of its parts somehow. Like, I think they were kind of striving to, like, you made a great point about how they could sound like anything over the last 15 years. I'd say even further, maybe even the last like 20 years, maybe. It's almost as if they were trying to go for something that was in between the Killers and like Radiohead's work in the early 2000s, but it just doesn't quite have the same impact, politically speaking, as Radiohead or, I don't know, that kind of stadium-sized drama anthemicness of the Killers from that era.
So maybe we should bring the review of of the Slow Readers Club to a close before we get into even more criticism. Stars out of 5 from you, Danny, because I don't think you liked it very much. You're Louise. Louise.
I'm sure they're interesting people, but the music unfortunately isn't. So it's also 2 from me.
Okay, well, we'll be back with Throwing Muses after this break. It's album reviews here on Arena, and Louise Bruton and Danny Kilmartin have been listening to Edwin Collins, The Slow Readers Club, and now we're moving on to Throwing Muses. Let's listen to a track. This is Summer of Love. That's Summer of Love from Moonlight Concessions, the new album from Throwing Muses. And I said Louise Bruton and Danny Kilmartin are here and they've listened to both. I know you're new to Throwing Muses, so you might bring us in first, Louise, into who they are.
Yeah, if we were to draw a family tree of alternative rock music of the 80s and 90s in America, Throwing Muses would have multiple branches coming out of them.
Because so influential.
So influential. So they were originally fronted by stepsisters and best friends, Kristen Hirsch and Tanya Donnelly. Tanya Donnelly went on to leave Throwing Muses to found Belly and then to also join Kim Deal to form The Breeders. And the Pixies used to actually support Throwing Muses when they were touring around. So there's this really nice community that's built up around them. And they were one of the first American acts to sign with the British label 4AD. So there's just this really nice early establishment of who they are and who they ride with, basically. And they became this very Vitals kind of sound in the kind of pre-grunge alternative rock music, really Radio College kind of sound across America, and just genuinely two very cool women. And Kirsten has continued with the band. Tanya no longer plays with them. There's good blood between them, though. No fallouts there. But it's now Kirsten's act, and she's really paved an even deeper voice for herself. Great songwriter, great storyteller.
Mm. So you were new coming to this band. So what do you make of the album? What are her concerns here?
I think this album is absolutely stunning. I'm just going to get that right out of the way. It seems to explore a lot of like the contradictions of life itself, you know, ranging from the mundane to the intense. I know that from having read interviews and stuff in the build up to the album that Kristen Hirsch has kind of had her own mental turmoil to kind of deal with over the years and to overcome, and the album seems to be really permeated with this awareness of impermanence and just reflection. It kind of reflects the band's own history too. From what I've read, they had a bit of a love-hate relationship with the music industry, having toured, you know, relentlessly from the early 80s into the late 90s before they decided to focus on other things. But despite all of that, it still seems really spontaneous and fun.
We could hear from that track, like, there's wonderful storytelling there. There's a whole short story in Summer of Love, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that's what I kind of got. It seems to me like the whole album is a collection of short stories, and they kind of range from, like I said, like the mundane, like the everyday occurrences that happen to her. Like you look at, say, something like Sally's Beauty, for example. But then you'd have Drugstore Drastic, which is one, a super catchy tune, but just lyrically, it's so surreal. But at the same time, there's something very, I've been there. I've had those kind of moments, no matter what the song is on the album, you know.
There's also this contrast between two places, Southern California, isn't it, and the Gulf of Mexico, which seems to us very near, Louise. But from Hirsch's point of view, she sees the world and the sky and the nighttime very differently.
When she was writing her song, she seems to always look up, and she seemed to see the duality in these places. So she said that when she was in New Orleans, the stars look greenish blue as it's below sea level and swamp lit, which is very setting. And then on Moonlight Beach, the stars glow icy white. So she wrote the songs between kind of New Orleans and California. And I really feel that she embodies the spirit of these places, kind of the contrasting images. Absolutely. That Danny was talking about. And Summer of Love is a very anecdotal song. So she seems to just almost like sit on the street and take in what's happening. And Summer of Love, rather fittingly, is all about a bet that the seasons don't affect our moods. And of course, they do, as we've all experienced in the last 2 weeks. So that was a song about her losing a bet because she was wrong.
And again, sonically, like, there's a lot of harsh guitar sounds here as well, as great storytelling.
Yeah, and there's some really pretty ones as well. I mean, you look at the track, I think it's Theremin, is how you pronounce it, for example. Like, it's really spectral and gothic, and just, it sounds lovely. But there's a lot of variety here. There's a lot of different guitar sounds. There's a lot of, like, on that track in particular, particular, where the bass kind of led it and the guitar kind of did the textural work. It's a very textural album, I think.
Okay, well, let's hear Albatross, which I think has a very different sound. Bit of Albatross there from Moonlight Concession from Throwing Muses. I think you both like this very much. Stars out of five from you, Danny.
4.5.
4.5. And from you, Louise?
A clear 4 from me.
4 from you. And the other albums were Edwin Collins's Nation Shall Speak Unto Nation, The Slow Readers Club, Out of a Dream, and of course Throwing Muses, which was Moonlight Concessions. Louise and Danny, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
That's it for tonight's show. Next Monday, which is St. Patrick's Day, you can listen in to us when we play again the Tradfest outside broadcast we did from Dublin Castle. So you'll have 353 Samba, Keela, Sharon Collins among the guests. So be sure to tune in at 7 for that. That's it, for tonight's show. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields were the researchers. Jamie Doyle was our Mark Dwyer was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next after the news.